Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I'd like to tell you about a terrific podcast called Time to Eat the Dogs. It's hosted by Michael Robinson, a historian, and it's about exploration. Now, if you're clever, and I know you are because you listen to the New Books Network, you can probably figure out why a podcast about exploration would be called Time to Eat the Dogs. Well, Michael has interviewed many scholars and historians and researchers, and he even interviewed an astronaut about their books about exploration. You can find Time to Eat the Dogs at TimeToEatTheDogs.com. What else? You can also find it on iTunes. As I say, we really love this podcast at the New Books Network, and we love it so much that we're going to republish some of Michael's excellent interviews. And if I would just stop talking, which I'm going to do presently, you'll be able to hear one of those interviews. So I'm going to stop talking.
You know, Marco Polo was something of a medieval rock star when he traveled from Europe to China on the Silk Road. Even though, if you look at his stuff, he was pretty dismissive of people and places along the way. And Kate Harris didn't think this was right, so she retraced his 10,000-kilometer route by bike. It's Time to Eat the Dogs. I'm Michael Robinson. Today I talk to Kate Harris, writer, scientist, and extreme cyclist, at least I would call her an extreme cyclist, about the trip she made with her friend Mel, tracing Marco Polo's route across Central Asia and Tibet. This journey is the subject of Harris's new book, Lands of Lost Borders, A Journey on the Silk Road, newly released from Knopf in Canada, where it is already, by the way, a top 10 book for 2018. Kate Harris, thank you for talking with me today.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here, Michael. Thanks for having me.
So could you talk about your first trip to Asia in 2006? Tell us a little bit about where you were in life and why you decided to go and where you went.
Sure, yeah. So in 2006, I had just graduated from university. And my friend and I, my friend Melissa, who's a big character in my book, decided we would bike the Silk Road. We had 4 months of summer holiday available to us, and I had managed to get this summer travel grant through my university that would enable this kind of trip. And I basically pitched it as following in the footsteps of Marco Polo. And what I didn't elaborate to the travel grant committee, but my underlying motivation for this journey was I was really, Marco Polo was a fallen hero to me at that point. You know, I grew up kind of admiring his travels and really worshiping him from a kid's perspective. Like, he just seemed this glamorous, romantic explorer figure than, at least from the, you know, children's books I read about him. Mm-hmm. But when I was at university, I read the fuller edition of his travels, the unabridged edition, and was kind of heartbroken to find out he was more of a merchant than a romantic, I guess.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to set off and bike through some of the places he most detested along the Silk Road, which were the places that interested me the most, you know, the mountains and deserts, everything in between the really fabled trading hubs. So that was the motivation for our trip. And we'd done one previous bike trip together, and I explained this in the book, but it was kind of a fluke, the order in which it happened. We biked across the U.S. because Mel got hit by a boat when we were supposed to leave for China for our Silk Road bike ride. So we had to postpone the Silk Road trip, but we biked across the U.S., which was a really good warm up because it meant we actually knew how to fix a flat tire by the time we hit the real Silk Road.
Right. And you, and it was on that first trip that you entered Tibet and saw the, how do you pronounce this? The Sichuan Glacier?
Yeah. I always pronounce it as Siachen, and then I heard an Indian person pronounce it and they said Siachen. So I'm probably doing it wrong, but I've always in my head read it as Siachen, but I think it's Siachen.
That becomes an important place for you and how you think about the upcoming trip after that.
That's right. Yeah. So we snuck into Tibet in 2006, literally snuck under a guardrail railing in the cover of night. And it all turned out to be quite unnecessary. Our stealth tactics were not called for at that point, but we managed to get into Tibet. And in the process, we biked through this borderland area called the Aksai Chin. And this is up against India. And it's contested territory even today with India, although China is in sort of de facto control of it. And the road we were biking on through this remote, far-flung corner of Western Tibet was the road that provoked a brief war between India and China over this territory. And so I didn't know much of this background during the trip. I mean, I saw a lot of military convoys when we were out there, and it was very clearly not your usual tourist track, I guess. but when I came back from that trip, I had the chance to study the history of science at Oxford. And I started looking into that corner of Tibet. And in looking into it, I learned it was such a contested borderland. And in the process, noticed that just across the border into India and Pakistan was this other highly contested borderland that is this glacier, the Siachen Glacier. So that's what sparked the intrigue.
So this was interesting to me when I read it, because you talk in your book about how important, really almost fundamental to who you are, this idea of travel and new experiences. And yet at the same time, you've got this these kind of stated goals for these expeditions, one to kind of retrace Marco Polo's journey, this other to look at borders and their effect on you know, influencing wildlife. And you have actually a really cool quote, if I can find it here. I wanted to bike the Silk Road as a practical extension of my thesis at Oxford to study how borders make and break what is wild in the world. That's a beautiful line.
Thank you.
So what do you think the chicken and the egg here is? Is it that you really wanted to go to Asia and bike the Silk Road and then kind of found a motive to do it? Or was it the motive that drove the expedition and the kind of experiences that you have kind of are the watershed of that?
Right. That's a great question. I think because I traveled first in the world vicariously, you know, it was through words, it was through reading books as a kid, that I really felt this thirst to see the world myself, reading about other people's journeys in it, especially their wild journeys. So I guess probably the reading sparked the idea to go myself, and also kind of the sort of questions I wanted to explore in the travels. But certainly a mix of both. I mean, if we hadn't snuck into Tibet on that first trip and traveled through this weird borderland that, you know, borders that exist to some people and not to others, and country of like conflicting claims, I don't know that I would have gone off to grad school after that and really honed in on borderlands as what I wanted.
Yeah.
So definitely they feed each other, like words and the world, sort of this back and forth.
I feel oftentimes with projects, I probably shouldn't announce this publicly, should I? But like, I become very interested in something because it's interesting. And then I reverse engineer a reason why I should do it or study it. And so I was just curious about it. But yeah, but I can see how the two feed each other in your text. And in fact, you do really give us some interesting pictures of these borderlands. And it, there's a kind of paradox to them, the way that you talk about them as these structures that keep people out, but in some cases actually kind of protect and maintain natural areas. Could you talk about that?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I think a quality of being young, and, you know, a lot of this book is, you know, is in my 20s when I was doing these trips. You know, you sort of have these black and white, very idealistic notions about how the world works or should work. And in reading so much about borders and borderlands and all their negative impacts and constricting effects on people and places and wildlife, I kind of set off on the Silk Road with a bit of a vendetta against borders. And there's nothing like travel to really force you to reconsider your black and white, you know, and see the gray in between. And along the way, we visit a whole bunch of different borderlands and saw a few examples where borders are perversely protecting landscapes and wildlife in a way that if those, you know, barbed wire fences didn't exist, these places would be impoverished in a biodiversity sense, which is not to downplay the like horrible impacts on people's lives that these borders can have. But, you know, one example of this was the border between Turkey and Armenia. And it's this canyon. It's running through the canyon is the river, formerly known as the Araxes to the Greeks, I guess. This canyon used to be, you know, you can look down into it and see the ruins of bridges. Like as recently as a century ago, people could just walk across this river and move freely between what is now eastern Turkey and western Armenia. And then this border was thrown down and it's been banned to human entry for decades now. And in that interim, this canyon became the sort of inadvertent wildlife sanctuary, and Egyptian vultures, which are an endangered threatened species, are nesting in this canyon because people can't go there. So that it's a refuge. And the DMZ between North and South Korea is another example of this, which I'd read about, you know, I'd studied it on paper when I was a grad student at Oxford, but actually seeing this play out in front of your eyes is another thing entirely.
Yeah. So what I really like about your book, and it's a really interesting mixture of your different interests in exploration. I mean, in a sense, I think you wear a lot of different hats. You're a student of exploration. You know, you studied that at Oxford. Then you went to work at MIT for your PhD studies. Is that correct? And was that in astrobiology?
That was my interest. Technically, the program was geobiology.
Geobiology. Yeah. And at the same time, and I know this from when I first met you about 8 years, must have been eight years ago, and you said, oh, I just read this Annie Dillard piece and you have to read it. And I think it was on the North Pole.
Yes, Expedition to the Pole.
That's right. And so I know that you're also very much a student of literature and travel literature. And I was just wondering how do you find your voice in all that when you're in two ways, I guess. One, when you're traveling, what's the voice that's going through your head? And two, how do you end up writing about it? I'll make this question even longer by saying that when I travel, this is always a question for me because I'm trying to be present in the moment, and you know, simultaneously I'm thinking about it like a writer.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting. This was the sort of long bike ride on the Silk Road was the first trip I set off on explicitly planning to write about it, in part because I'd quit my PhD at MIT and had no future other than if and when I could could actually turn writing into a, not a career exactly, but something that would keep me going. So I, you know, I kept elaborate notes during the trip, and at first I was really, really diligent about writing down, you know, every detail, the day in and day out of what we were seeing and doing. And then I sort of realized along the way that it was an exhausting amount of detail, and you can't, I didn't want to write a trip that was about the day to day. Like, I wanted to weave in bigger ideas about exploration historically and, you know, what it means in the modern world that's far more mapped and tamed. And I wanted to weave in literature, sort of all my, different obsessions in life that, make the world interesting to me. And so I knew, you know, it wasn't going to be like day one, we biked here, we ate this. And so I started being a little more, you could call it lazy on one hand or practical on the other, and just sort of jotting down like what moments really were, what came alive to me on the Silk Road, you know, what sort of images and metaphors, what I was reading as I biked the Silk Road caught my attention, because we have a wonderful amount of time to read on a bike trip because you can only bike so many hours of a day. And so I tried to keep notes that were, they're much more fragmentary, much more evocative, you know, how the light looked in these trees and you know, what the birds were doing and what I was hearing. And so, yeah, I came back and I still had an enormous amount of material to try and work up into the book. But in the end, it was those sort of glimmerings along the road that brought the writing alive. And the writing was just a process of eliminating, paring down to, you know, what specific scenes and what specific moments and encounters and musings in your mind, bring the trip alive to someone else who wasn't actually on it, but who wants to go on that emotional and intellectual journey.
Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I wonder, since you're talking about your writing, if you wouldn't mind reading a passage for us. It's from your journey through Georgia, I believe.
Yes.
Do you mind reading an excerpt from that?
You bet.
And actually, probably if you could set up the scene.
Yeah,
for us.
Sure. So we're in Georgia, right on the border of Azerbaijan and Russia, in this national park called Lagodeki. And we've been there for a few days, and nothing really makes any sense to us. You know, there's a language barrier. There's just a lot that is really hard to read between the lines of when you're a foreigner in a foreign land. So we've been trying to talk to as many people as we can in this park to figure out, like, how does it work with conservation across borders? How do people exist here? So the passage as follows. "So what do you people do here for a living?" I'd asked. "I'm not sure," he'd confessed with a helpless, homesick look. This was a Peace Corps volunteer. In some ways, it was the clearest answer we'd heard yet. It was certainly the most honest response he could have given. For other than exposing the obvious differences between a foreign land and wherever you're from, the way the Polish explorer noticed a peony growing in Georgia and nowhere else, Travel reveals less about the truth of a place and hints more at how complicated the world is, how reeling and inscrutable.
Thank you for reading that. I think one reason I really like that passage is I think it kind of digs at a dilemma of exploration or a dilemma of travel between going deep and going broad. Are you going to learn a place by living in a place for a number of years, or are you going to try to learn by traveling through? And here it feels to me like you're kind of acknowledging that that there's a kind of ignorance about travel too.
Yeah.
Because you're moving through things, landscapes, and seeing people so quickly. So how do you process that?
Yeah, this is something I thought about so much on the trip, because you know you're just skimming the surface. And it takes a certain arrogance in a way, which I hope I've not indulged in too much, but to write about places where you're a stranger, you don't know really how things work or who people are. You have these sort of glancing impressions. And it's what makes travel incredibly exciting, because it's all new, it's all unknown, but it also makes it frustrating, because you know, you're just kind of not getting to the depths that you would get to if you could actually talk to people in their own language or spend longer periods in a place. And I'll always love this kind of travel, you know, that's just kind of whizzing through a place, if whizzing is a word that can apply to bicycle travel. But I'm definitely more drawn now to lingering and getting to know the neighborhood on a deeper level. It's partly what I love about my day-to-day life in Canada's north. You know, I live in this tiny cabin in a tiny community, and all around us is wilderness, mountains and forests and wildlife and an ice field. And there's such joy in sort of the deeper kind of travel you can do in a place, that you're not the thing moving. The world is moving around you, and it's noticing those changes and those differences from day to day and season to season. That's another kind of travel, and one I'm increasingly addicted to. And I think, I definitely want to keep a mix in my life, but you can get different things from each sort of version of, quote, exploration.
Yeah. I sometimes think of exploration as being on this continuum. People are heading out into the world to figure out the world, and then people heading out into the world to figure out themselves.
Right.
And I think, you know, probably if you look at most expeditions or even just travel experiences, they're somewhere on that continuum. And reading your book, it's very interesting, because it seems like there are these moments of exhilaration are most attached to you understanding yourself or living in that moment or seeing something kind of anew, as you said in this, what is exploration, but seeing the world anew. And yet this life that you're telling me about now is a kind of different life, or you're in one place. There was another line that I really liked. You were quoting Joan Didion, who said, "We tell ourselves stories in order to live." And so I was just wondering, has that story changed for you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if it weren't changing, or if it's, you know, if it became one story that I'm sticking with the rest of my life, I'd be pretty sad. Part of the joy of life is following the different stories your life becomes. And, the story I needed to live when I was a kid was that I could become an astronaut and go to Mars, because that was the last frontier left that a human being could conceivably kind of walk around on and plant a flag. You know, for someone as I was, who wanted to be an explorer in a pretty historic understanding of the word, that was a story I needed, because I looked around at the world and it looked awfully paved over and fenced and full of subdivisions from what I could see in the small town where I grew up. And then as I got older, you know, that story has definitely changed. You know, you sort of at least I have, I just fall deeper and deeper into love with this planet, however sort of flawed and compromised it might be. I really feel like my loyalties are here, and there's so much to explore. You know, it's a really naive read on novelty to think that you have to be the very first person to do something or see something or feel something for that feeling or sight or experience to be worthwhile. Like, that's absurd. And you know, I write in the book about how, like, the most powerful experiences available to us as human beings alive for this brief period of time on this planet in the middle of nowhere in a vast universe, you know, they're not amenable to maps. Like, no one else can explore for you. Just because someone's been to the peak of Everest before doesn't mean you climbing up there isn't one of the most powerful experiences you can have in your lifetime. And maybe not Everest, it's a bit too crowded. I'm really convinced that exploration is not something that like an elite few do in remote places that are hard to get to. It's really an attitude you can apply to your daily life, just bringing a sense of wonder to the world around you. So I guess that's my story now. We'll see what it is in a decade.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to see how your younger self, you know, gets annoyed at Charles Darwin and Marco Polo for kind of lacking the sufficient wonder in the coolness of the world. And it's also kind of neat that I think as a younger person, you were interested in kind of doing a redo of Polo's journey. It reminded me a little bit just in let's say in approach to, you know, Alexander von Humboldt.
Oh yeah.
When he was traveling to the New World, you know, he wasn't really going anywhere that hadn't been either known by Native Americans for thousands of years or by Europeans for hundreds of years. And yet, in a sense, he was rediscovering it or creating a new vision of it, which was really, you know, neither like the old European version or the indigenous version. It was this new creation. So I think that's kind of a cool, you know, way to look at it.
Yeah, like traveling into old lands with new questions. Like that is as close to exploration as one could hope to get.
So what do you see as your next project? What are you looking at?
Well, my latest sort of love affair is with the sky. I'm learning how to fly. And it's always been a dream of mine, you know, since I looked up at the stars and wanted to be an astronaut. Flight was a big part of that. You know, I looked at what astronauts did even when they were back on Earth, and it was, they got to fly planes and, you know, scuba dive and go on wilderness survival courses in Siberia. And so in a way, I think I'm trying to piece together a life that has those elements. Flight is definitely a theme that runs through the book, you know, the relationship between bicycles and early airplanes and then early airplanes and missions to the moon. I've never really had the time or space to get my private pilot's license, but that's what I'm working on now. And I love it. I love it. Like, there's the feeling of lifting off from the earth and, you know, it's not under your own power exactly, but you're at the controls and you're suddenly moving in with 6 degrees of freedom over a world that you've never seen this way before, despite a million transatlantic commercial flights. And I just love it. And it's challenging in a sort of technical way, which appeals to the scientific side of me. And, you know, I just love learning new systems and theories. Mm-hmm. And then the sort of part of me that just likes adventure and seeing things from a different point of view, it's thrilling for that too, especially flying in the Canadian North around mountains and lakes and ice fields. So I don't really know where that's going. You know, I've never never had much of a plan beyond sort of what I can see on the horizon, other than sort of themes that I think mm-hmm. will be consistent through my life, which, you know, wondering about things and writing about them. So I'm sure it'll show up in my writing somehow. And then the other adventure is just living off the grid in sort of a little spaceship of a cabin where you have to make mm-hmm. sure you have enough energy coming in and you have water to manage and all the life support systems that we take advantage of or take for granted in more sophisticated buildings and places. So I'm just loving being a homesteader.
That sounded very much like a Martian-like statement to be self-sufficient and know the amount of energy coming in is the amount.
Yeah.
It's great. Well, Kate Harris, thanks so much for talking with me
today. Oh, it was my great pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
That's it for today. Next week, I talk to Jane Hooper about trade and travel on the Indian Ocean in the 1600s, which is the subject of her new book, Feeding Globalization. The music for Time to Eat the Dogs was composed by Zabrat. If you'd like to recommend a guest or offer an opinion, feel free to email me at timetoeatthedogs, that's one word, lowercase, @gmail.com. And please rate the show and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. It's really one of the best ways of reaching new listeners who might be interested in the show. See you next week.